from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We may be there at the red line that's been talked and talked about in Syria. Last Wednesday, gruesome deaths outside Damascus and a strong charge of chemical weapons use. Today, four U.S. Navy destroyers within striking distance of Syria. The president has huddled with his top security team. There are loud global voices for and against intervention. This hour on Point, a finger on the trigger over Syria. You can join us on air or online. Should the U.S. and others intervene militarily in Syria? Should it? Should we? Should they not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Damascus in Syria is Sam Dagher, Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Sam, welcome to On Point. Do you hear, see, feel in Syria fear or expectation of a military intervention by foreign powers in coming days?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the number one concern for a lot of Syrians here in the capital. And people are already bracing themselves for such a possibility. And we're seeing people stock up on food, on water, on essentials. So it's a very tense atmosphere here in the capital at the moment.
Russia and others loudly saying no, but France saying something needed after last week's attack. The British Foreign Secretary is saying UN sanction not required here to go in. If there is to be, and who knows, but what do Syrians say or think about what kind of attack they might see if one should come?
Well, I'll give you the reaction of President Assad. I mean, in an interview that was published today in Izvestia, the Russian daily, he basically mocks, the U.S. accusations and says, you know, this really defies logic. I mean, how can the U.S. Come out and say that it highly suspects that, the regime was responsible for chemical weapons and then says it's going to go ahead and gather evidence itself? So we obviously have a very defiant tone from President Assad himself. And he also said that, whoever is dreaming that Syria is going to be a Western puppet, then, they should continue to dream on. So that's from Assad himself.
What about the UN weapons inspectors? What are the expectations there in the Syrian government, perhaps, and among foreign observers in the country that the UN team might indeed come up with firm evidence on last week's big alleged chemical attack?
Right. I mean, that's what they're doing at the moment. They left their hotel in central Damascus shortly after 11 a.m. local time. And the government came out yesterday and said that it reached an agreement with the inspectors that would allow them to go into these areas. And some of these areas are southwest of the city. We're just talking a few miles away in each direction. And then some of the areas are east of the city. And today, the inspectors visited a town called Mardamia, where the opposition is saying that the regime used chemical weapons last week in attacks that killed about 60 civilians. But you have to understand, I mean, these areas are complete war zones, and they have been so for months and months. I mean, just to give you an example, Mardamia has been besieged by military forces since December, and a senior UN official here with one of humanitarian agencies based in Damascus told me that they'd been pleading with the government to be able to deliver aid to this particular town, but they haven't been able to secure consent from the Syrian government. So, the world needs to understand that these areas are war zones. There's been, and some days the regime makes advances. On other days, the rebels are able to repulse the regime forces. So they're very, very sort of hostile zones for a while. And let's see what they come back with from Mardamia. The opposition has been streaming live video from Mardamia showing the inspectors interviewing residents. My assumption is that they can be able to collect samples as well. First thing, they could probably give us a confirmation that some sort of a chemical substance was used, and based on their maybe based on what they gather and some of the evidence and the testimonies, maybe one can also make certain conclusions about who perhaps used it, whether it was the regime or the rebels. But obviously, they did stress that's not part of their mission to apportion blame.
Sam, briefly, what kind of timetable do people imagine for a UN finding on these attacks?
Well, again, it all depends on whether they're going to be able to enter the other area, which is east of here. I mean, that's like supposedly the epicenter of this chemical attack that took place last Wednesday. We're talking about a place that Syrians commonly refer to as the Ghouta, the Eastern Ghouta. These are like a sprawling area of farmland dotted with like some pretty major towns with like populations of, before the conflict of 200,000 plus, and a lot of factories and so on and so forth. And so it's critical that they enter the eastern suburbs, because that's where a lot of this stuff was supposed to have taken place. In one area alone, there are accusations that the chemical weapons attack by the regime killed at least 400 people. This is a town called Zamalka, east of here. So it's critical that they go to these places, and they haven't been able to do that today because our understanding is fighting is ongoing, and the government is hitting some of these areas east of Damascus with artillery and rockets. And I can actually hear the outgoing artillery and rockets from where I am in Damascus.
Sam Dagher in Damascus for the Wall Street Journal. Sam, please stay safe there, and thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We're looking at what's going on in Syria and whether or not we may be on the brink of some kind of intervention there. Certainly the talk is very high. Here's a sound from last week. This was a chemical weapons attack, alleged, last Wednesday, reported to have killed hundreds. One man here described what happened to his family.
My father, mother, all my sisters and brothers, plus at least 50 neighbors, collapsed on the floor. I managed to bring my little sisters and two other girls to this field hospital, but nothing is left in Zamalka.
Here's President Obama in a segment aired this morning on CNN.
Unlike some of the evidence that we were trying to get earlier that led to a UN investigator going into Syria, what we've seen indicates that this is clearly a big event of grave concern.
Grave concern. And here's Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker yesterday on Fox News Sunday urging the president to respond militarily in a surgical way.
I think we will respond in a surgical way, and I hope the president, as soon as we get back to Washington, will ask for authorization from Congress to do something in a very surgical and proportional way, something that gets their attention, that causes them to understand that we are not going to put up with this kind of activity.
Loud voices around the world for and against a military response to what's being described as a potential chemical attack of grave concern by the President of the United States there. Joining me now from Washington is Christopher Harmer, Senior Naval Analyst with the Middle East Security Project at the Institute for the Study of War. That's a think tank founded by Kimberly Kagan, prominent advocate of intervention and the surge in Iraq. Christopher Harmer served 20 years as a career officer in the U.S. Navy, wrote the report Required Sorties and Weapons to Degrade Syria Air Force, Excluding Integrated Air Defense System, detailing how the U.S. might intervene in Syria. Christopher Harmer, welcome to On Point.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Are there effective options here? There's been a lot of skepticism expressed over time, militarily.
Well, let me start by saying, first, I'd like to offer condolences to the victims and recognize that this is a human tragedy of epic proportions. I am a technical analyst. I can tell you what's going on. I can tell you what the options are. And so sometimes I speak of those in impersonal terms because that's the way you have to analyze these things. But the reality is we're dealing with a situation where there's at least 100,000 Syrians dead. Overwhelmingly, those are civilians, at least 1.5 million, possibly 2 million refugees and internally displaced persons. So it's a real tragedy. And I'd like to start my comments simply by saying that we should all acknowledge that tragedy and keep in mind that this is what we're dealing with is a human tragedy. Following on to that, you are correct in that Dr. Kagan, who's the founder and president of the Institute for the Study of War, she does speak out on in policy terms. I do not. I speak out simply as a technical analyst as a former weaponeer, as a former targeteer, as a former naval aviator, I can tell you what the options are. I can tell you how to do it. In general, I try to stay away from recommending policies because I need to be able to speak on to people on both sides of the aisle.
So you know, just talking intervention is, yeah, it ends up being having a kind of spin of its own. But here we are. Our time is short before the break, but I don't know. Give us one or two. What might they be thinking about in the Pentagon?
Okay, so right now you've got four Navy destroyers off the coast of Syria. Those have 90 missiles each. About half of those are Tomahawk missiles. About 45 missiles per destroyer. So you're talking 180 Tomahawk missiles. With that, you could completely destroy the Syrian Air Force. The reason I think that the Syrian Air Force is the most obvious target is that is the most effective way to deliver chemical weapons. If you think back to 1988 when Saddam Hussein attacked the Kurds and dropped chemical weapons on them, that's what he used. He used air delivery using
fixed-wing aircraft. Do we know that the Air Force would have been used last week? Could it have been just lobbed an artillery shell out of Damascus?
No, we don't know for sure, but it appears that it was not used. It appears it was just artillery shells. Yeah. The reason I think that the priority is going to be attacking the Syrian Air Force is if you remove the Air Force, then you limit the range of the artillery that can be used. It can only go out to maybe 10, 12 miles maximum.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the military intervention option in Syria after hundreds died last week in what has many hallmarks of a serious chemical attack. Certainly the President of the United States is talking about it as a matter of grave concern. UN investigators now on the ground there, and more talk about foreign military intervention, kind of retaliatory over this, than we have heard for a long time. Russia loudly saying no. The United States, Pentagon saying it's preparing options. France saying some kind of military response required here. Of course, they've been allied with the opposition in Syria. The British Foreign Secretary saying today UN sanction not required for military intervention. The Russian Foreign Minister saying it would be a grave error. Here's all kinds of people talking about this. This was the General Secretary of the Syrian opposition at the end of last week, Badr Jamas, talking about the alleged chemical attack, criticizing the U.S. for not following through on its red line promise, interpreted by CNN.
What are the red lines for the American administration? When will they? Is the red line in there with Obama is different from ours? We are killing and massacres, and red lines have been crossed, and the American administration has failed to take any action.
Fast talker there. All the way last Wednesday, State Department spokesman Jen Psaki sort of really going around here on the red line challenge from reporters asking her about what had happened in Syria.
I'm not talking about red lines. I'm not having a debate or conversation about red lines, or I'm not setting red lines. Let's not talk about red today.
Here's the Syrian information minister, Assad's man, denying the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government on Syrian state television, interpreted here by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Everything that has been said is absurd, primitive, illogical, and fabricated. What we say is what we mean. There is no use of chemical weapons at all, at least not by the Syrian army or the Syrian state, and it's easy to prove.
Okay, but those images looked pretty bad coming out last week. Yesterday in Malaysia, U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel said President Obama has asked the military to, quote, prepare options for all contingencies around Syria.
President Obama has asked the Defense Department to prepare options for all contingencies. We have done that. And we are prepared to exercise whatever option if he decides to employ one of those options.
Christopher Harmer is with us, served 20 years as a career officer in the U.S. Navy. He's now at the Institute for the Study of War. Jonathan Tepperman is with us from New York City, managing editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine. Jonathan Tepperman, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
We're walking through military options here with Christopher. What's the strategic envelope around this? Is there an American interest in going in, or is the president in a box of his own former statements about red lines, an international law box? How do you see it, Jonathan?
I think the answer to the first question stems from the answer to the second. There is an American interest in going in, and it owes in part to the fact that the president has painted himself into a corner by making very definitive statements about chemical weapons use being a red line just about a year ago, and then failing to act when the Syrians have repeatedly crossed it in the 12 months since then. So there is a strong international reason for the United States to do something now, and that's to reestablish the credibility that's been so badly damaged by the lack of American interest in the last year in Syria, and now the lack of involvement and the lack of American involvement in Egypt as well. And then I would argue there are a host of other reasons that it would be in American interest to intervene, such as stabilizing what's absolutely a critical region or preventing the further destabilization. But it's not clear to me that any of those priorities appeal to the administration at this point.
Let's look at the military options, then we can begin to make some assessments for ourselves about whether or not they would appear to lead towards stabilization. Christopher Harmer, you took us first to those four destroyers now in the Mediterranean in shooting distance of Syria with piles and piles of missiles ready to go. You think what you say, we could take out the entire Syrian Air Force? There's an option. That sounds pretty drastic. What else? What other options might Chuck Hagel be laying before the president?
In general, there's five options that you can really look at. First is the missile strikes. We're positioned to do that right now. Going up the ladder of escalation, the next would be manned aircraft strikes. We're really not positioned to do that, but we could do so shortly.
To do what?
Well, same thing. If you want to, number one, if we wanted to completely obliterate the Air Force, start taking out artillery tubes, rocket launchers, manned aircraft strikes just present, there's more mass that you can throw at the problem. I'm not advocating for that. I'm simply saying that's the next step up the escalatory ladder. The next step after that is actively patrolling a no-fly zone. I think a no-fly zone is irrelevant because I think we can destroy the Syrian Air Force pretty easily if we decided to. The next step up from there is establishing a humanitarian safe zone along the border with Jordan and along the border with Turkey. That would require manned aircraft actively patrolling it to prevent Syrian regime forces from going into that humanitarian safe zone. And then, of course, the worst or most escalatory measure would be an active invasion, boots on the ground. I don't think anybody's thinking about that. I don't think anybody wants that. I'm just merely laying out for you the, in general, five options that there are out there right now.
You take us on the up escalator with those options. I think maybe we should look at the down escalator, because the Obama administration's reluctance to get involved here has been so evident for so long. Surely they're looking at options shy of a full-on missile barrage that would, as you say, totally take out the Syrian Air Force. What about lighter options than that?
Well, sure. One of the things that military planners always want to know is, what is the off-ramp to escalation? It's very easy to define how to escalate up. What is the de-escalatory step?
Even get there, I'm asking something else.
Gotcha.
Lighter intervention than destroying the Syrian Air Force. I'm guessing President Obama will be saying, well, I mean, I have no idea, but I'm guessing he'd say, Chuck, you know, isn't there something we can do that will just, you know, hit him hard somewhere very surgically, as we heard Senator Corker saying there, without getting into the scale of taking out the Air Force?
The absolute minimum actual military option would be to attack the Syrian Integrated Air Defense System, the IADS. They really don't use it against the rebels because the rebels don't have any air power. So the Syrians have these heavy radars and heavy missile systems that were built in the 70s and 80s to defend them against the Israeli Air Force. That's something that's almost irrelevant to the Assad regime right now. If President Obama wanted to simply send a message, he could hit that Syrian Integrated Air Defense System with a missile strike. That wouldn't really affect the balance of power, but it might send a message to Assad that we're serious about responding to the use of chemical weapons.
Jonathan Tepperman, I still kind of imagine President Obama looking for something maybe even lighter than that. You know, a few missiles that take out a palace or a particular command center or some ammunition dump. I don't know, Jonathan. Can you imagine lighter still?
I can. And frankly, Tom, I think that you're reading the tea leaves and reading the president just right, because he has shown so little stomach for involvement thus far. It's hard to imagine him going in a robust way. So, right, what are we talking about? My expectation, some kind of a pinpoint strike akin to those that President Clinton launched against Sudan and Afghanistan in 1998 after the bombings of two U.S. embassies in Africa. In the case of Sudan, it destroyed destroyed one chemical factory thought to be a weapons plant. In the case of Afghanistan, it destroyed two terrorist facilities that had been emptied out hours before. So we saw a little of some big bangs, a little bit of rubble, and nothing more than that.
Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to know why chemical intervention is such a threshold item. What's the difference to an individual if he is blown apart by an artillery shell or riddled with machine gun bullets or stabbed in the eye with a bayonet or throat cut? Murder is murder. Dead is dead.
I mean, I take your point. I think I'd take a shell to a slow, strangulated kind of chemical death. But still, I absolutely take your point. Jonathan, why chemical weapons as a threshold item for intervention?
Gosh, that is such a good question. The answer is, to answer the question, you have to look back to history, and specifically to World War I, which is the only conflict where chemical weapons were used widely and resulted in not just the death, but the maiming, the horrible mutilation of many, many, many soldiers who didn't die. And after the war, much of the world got together and concluded that these weapons were so gruesome and left so many ongoing injuries in people who did survive that they should be banned. So in 1925, the countries of the world got together and they passed a sweeping chemical weapons convention, which has remained in force until today. And a lot of experts argue that in order to keep that taboo against the use of these weapons in force, it's necessary to act swiftly and decisively on the rare occasions that they are to prevent or sort of to reinforce this taboo as well as the legal ban. But, you know, from the perspective of somebody who's killed, it really doesn't make much difference. I think it's to those who survive that the distinction matters.
So you talk about U.S. credibility here. This also raises the question of international law. It does sit there. There it is on the books, and whether or not it's going to be observed, enforced, if that's the right word. Mona in Boston, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Mona.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to make the point that I agree with your guest that if we don't intervene, our credibility is at line at stake here. But on the flip side, though, I don't think Assad's regime is crazy enough to to cross the line. I don't think they're the ones to do that. That they would know this is committing suicide in a way. And they didn't need it. So it does not make sense for them to hurt a few hundred civilians and cross that red line. So I think whoever has done this wants U.S. intervention, wants the world to intervene. But I don't think it was make sense for them to do such a thing.
Looks crazy to you, Mona. I appreciate your call. Christopher Harmer, take that on. I mean, the Syrian government, that's exactly what they're saying. That would be nuts to have done this. We didn't do it. We're being set up here. From what we've read and heard, is there an obvious dynamic suggesting one way or the other, you know, a real attack by the government or a setup job?
Well, certainly a false flag operation is a possibility. I think it's highly unlikely. If you look at the entire history of the now 30-month Syrian civil war, every time there has been either an explicit or implicit red line established for Assad, he's gone straight up to that red line, he's pulsed that red line, and eventually he's sort of conditioned the West to accept him operating at or beyond that red line. Really quickly, he started by using artillery against civilians. That was supposedly a red line. He crossed it. Yeah. Nothing happened. Then using airstrikes against civilians, then using missile strikes against civilians with Scud missiles, now using chemical weapons. I absolutely am of the opinion that it's possible that this was a false flag operation. But I think if you look at the history of Assad's, the way he's prosecuted this war, he's continually expanded his range of operations beyond what were ostensible red lines. And so I think it's the overwhelming probability is that this was, in fact, an Assad regime operation. There's some very specific military reasons why he would have done this in that specific area.
And he appears to have used chemical weapons on a smaller scale before. I mean, it is his entire regime on the line here, so there's incentive. But, you know, Mona's question lingers there. If there should be some big intervention could be a miscalculation. Beth in Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't want to be a fearmonger or anything, but I just wanted to comment about the safety of the inspectors once they're in there and under more or less under Assad's protection, so to speak.
Yes, which they were going in and faced sniper fire, destroyed or damaged one of the first cars in the convoy, had to go back and regroup. So, yeah,
right.
But if they go in and find something, what?
If they go in and find something, then what is going to happen to the inspectors?
Jonathan Tepperman, what about that? You know, if they come out with the sort of kryptonite that could bring on the intervention, is Assad really going to just, you know, let them traipse in front of TV cameras?
I suspect he will, for the simple reason that there's so much scrutiny on him and on them, that having let them into the country, I think he's made a decision that he may try, in fact, will try to interfere with their work as much as possible, as we saw today, if it turns out that the government was behind the sniper attack. But it's very hard to imagine the inspectors actually being detained, imprisoned, harmed, killed. If you look back in history, just from the last couple of decades, and the role of chemical weapons inspectors and nuclear weapons inspectors mm-hmm. in Iraq, as much as Saddam Hussein didn't want them there, he always knew better than to actually put them in real harm's way.
I mean, the Russians and Chinese on the Security Council are one thing still leaning against intervention, and quite loudly on the Russian part. Why provoke that? Abbas in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Abbas, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So there's two points that I want to make. The reason, if we go to Syria, the one reason that we want to go is to serve the Israeli interest into cutting that connection between Iran and Hezbollah. My second point is, I'm totally against it because there are 35 foreign nationalities fighting in Syria. And the good rebel group are the smaller group. These people, once we help them, they're going to turn Syria into another Islamic state, worse than Saudi Arabia. And, sir, I am Muslim, but I'm against these kind of Islamic states because these people killed. I saw videos on YouTube. These people were lashing people.
Some real hardcore Islamists in there as well. Abbas, I appreciate your call. What about those two points, Jonathan Tepperman? We have just a minute and a half before the break.
Well, what Abbas does point to is the fact that we really face no good options in Syria today. A victory by Assad would be terrible for the people of Syria, for the region, and for U.S. interests, because it would strengthen both an opponent of the administration in Syria and strengthen the Iranian government as well, which is helping Assad in his efforts. But a victory by the rebels would not necessarily be a good thing from U.S. interests either, given the increasing power within the rebel movement of these very hardcore al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda-linked extremists. And that's part of what makes this situation so scary and so hard for the president.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the military intervention option in Syria. After hundreds died last week in what is the hallmarks of a serious chemical attack, certainly it's being treated as that potentially, and as that potentially perpetrated by the Syrian government. Red line, no red line, the talk is hot right now. But it's not an easy situation to get engaged in at all. And the Obama administration has been highly reluctant to do that. Jonathan Tepperman is with us from Foreign Affairs Magazine. Christopher Harmer from the Institute for the Study of War served 20 years as a career officer in the U.S. Navy. Christopher, Jonathan, lots of response online here. Monica says, please, no U.S. invasion, please. Very straightforward. Then Stephen says, who defends the defenseless? If not us, then who? DJ says, stay out of it. Help the victims, but stay out of the fight. Ed says, like before World War I, this could escalate quickly. Jonathan Tepperman, what about the consequences of intervention? A, is there a, you know, hit them hard and fast and get back out and stay out path that's realistically open? And if there's not, after some hit here, what might follow? What about this, concern about escalation in all kinds of directions.
Right. Well, this is part of what makes this decision, as so many others in Syria, so difficult for the administration, because each military option that it could pursue has potential advantages, but big downsides as well. If you just do a pinpoint strike to punish, like we were discussing earlier, you don't end up doing much. You may deter the Assad regime from using chemical weapons in the future, but it's not going to stop the carnage. If you decide to destroy Syria's chemical weapons stockpiles, or to try, it's unlikely that you'll succeed because the intelligence isn't very good. They're dispersed around the country. There's the chance that you'll accidentally release these chemicals into the atmosphere. If you start a larger campaign to tip the balance or kill Assad, this is a problem. Number one, Obama has shown that he's not very interested. Number two, there's a lot of reluctance on behalf of Secretary of Defense Hagel and the U.S. military to get involved in that kind of a campaign. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Martin Dempsey has been unusually explicit in arguing against such a path, warning that a campaign, a no-fly zone alone would cost $1 billion a month. And, of course, anything that gets the United States more involved in the conflict then carries all these other costs that this president, who, remember, has pulled the United States successfully out of one conflict in the Muslim world and is desperately trying to get out of another in Afghanistan, has absolutely no appetite for.
Mm. Let's listen. Here was the French foreign minister. This is Laurent Fabius yesterday at a press conference in Israel. Saying the attack, chemical attack, he says, in Syria cannot go unanswered.
Le massacre chimique.
The massacre, the chemical massacre.
Qui est intervenu en Syrie et dont, à l'évidence, la responsabilité est celle du régime, ne peut pas être acceptée.
Which happened in Syria and is evidently the responsibility of the regime cannot go unanswered.
Here's a voice from the not-so-distant past, Mr. You Break It, You Own It, former Secretary of State and General Colin Powell, urging caution in any American intervention in either Syria, or for that matter in Egypt, he was saying here.
To think that we can change things immediately just because we're America, that's not necessarily the case. These are internal struggles. And the parties inside those countries are going to have to sort it out amongst themselves.
You break it, you own it, Colin Powell famously said, and then came Iraq and Afghanistan. Christopher Harmer, can you see some kind of engagement that's quick, that, you know, replies to the offense if it's determined that this was a chemical weapon, but then removes the U.S. and allies or whoever goes in and does not involve a long tail?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there is a possibility of simply taking a single strike, then leaving. I mean, that's what we did in Libya in 1986. Libyans or Muammar Gaddafi was accused of bombing the discotheque in Berlin, killing American soldiers. In response, we conducted a one-time strike against Libya. That was it. I think it's significantly less likely that we would be able to intervene in Syria and just walk away without any ongoing commitment. The one point I'd like to make is tactical action, such as bombing Syria or taking a missile strike against Syria, unless it's serving a strategic aim, it's almost certain to be counterproductive. That's one thing that military planners have almost universal agreement on, is you shouldn't do something unless you know exactly why you're doing it and what you expect to get out of it. That's why I'm so wary of the idea of a punitive strike. I agree with Jonathan that our credibility is at stake, but I'm a lot less worried about our credibility than I am about getting involved in something without a clear idea of why we're doing it. We got to have a clear understanding of what we're trying to do, and we've got to be able to tie that tactical action to our strategic aims. And if we can't do that, then we shouldn't get involved.
But Jonathan Tepperman, I think I heard you leaning toward intervention at this point. So what about the question Christopher raises, the bigger picture and where it goes?
So my position for some time now has been that the United States should intervene. But I agree with Chris that you need to answer some very difficult questions before you do it. A limited tactical strike merely for the purpose of reestablishing U.S. credibility would probably not be worth it and may well do more harm than good. I think if you intervene in a more robust way, though, you have to have a better sense of what the end game is. Now, at this point, what is starting to give have a lot of proponents of intervention, myself included, who are much more gung-ho a year ago, the way that the composition of the rebel movement, the opposition, has changed in the last year. What you've seen is the moderates losing influence and these the extremist elements linked to Al-Qaeda or not that I was referring to earlier gaining in influence. And so there is the risk that if we back these guys and weaken Assad sufficiently that they manage in overthrowing them, that we will get either an Al-Qaeda stan or something like that in this strategically vital region. Now, there are other experts whom I respect who argue the die is not cast yet, that we still have time to influence the rebels to ensure that it's not the most radical extreme elements that take over. And I think that we should be doing everything possible to help shape the opposition movement so that the relative good guys are the ones who predominate.
But, boy, that sounds like a tall order.
It sure is. And it leaves other questions, still more difficult questions, unanswered. Like, how do you address the now toxic ethnic split in Syria? Remember, the Assad regime represents a small minority of the country. An ethnic group, a religious group called the Alawites, who are about 10% of the population. How do you keep the Sunni majority, historically repressed by the Alawites, from massacring that small minority once they take power?
Christopher Hammer, we just got a couple more minutes here. We're going to look at the Syrian refugee situation in a moment. But imagine that you're Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, and the president says to you, Mr. Secretary, we can't just stand by. We have to do something. You know, this is a bad chemical attack. Give me an option that will be a punitive strike that will let the whole world know that we responded to this, that would do some kind of surgical damage to Assad, but that wouldn't have a tail, that would let us go in, do it, and leave. What would you suggest?
I'd have to default back to the integrated air defense system because that is not serving any purpose for the Syrian regime right now. They are completely vulnerable to airstrike for all practical purposes anyway.
So why even hit it? What's the point?
Well, because you're talking about punitive action.
I see.
I'd preface that by saying
it's not really
simply,
punitive if they don't need it.
Well, are we talking about substantive action or punitive action?
I'm talking about a substantive, surgical, punitive strike that would not require long-term engagement, which is, I'm just speculating that that's something the president might find attractive right now.
Gotcha. And I have to reiterate, we have to separate punitive from substantive. If we have an interest, we've got to serve that interest, and our military action has to be in service of a strategic aim. Punitive strikes serve no strategic aim. That's we're back on the sixth grade playground here, throwing temper tantrums that doesn't help.
That's exactly the point at which a president might say to a Secretary of Defense, I hear you, but right now we need an action here. Give me an option.
We've got an action, and I would say the Syrian Air Force has at most 100 functional airframes that they're using to target civilian population. Mm-hmm. Let's target those 100 airframes mm-hmm. with 100 cruise missiles. Let's take out their air power. Right. Let's reduce their ability to deliver chemical weapons with aircraft. Let's reduce their ability to deliver conventional bombs against civilians. Let's take out their air force. We can do that in one night.
All right. Well, we are no closer to knowing what will happen, but we're better informed about what the options might be and some of their implications. There are many, many off this, and of course, many voices in this country and around the world also saying, don't get involved. We will see. Christopher Hammer at the Institute for the Study of War in Washington, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, sir.
And Jonathan Tepperman, Managing Editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine in New York. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I want to turn to the issue of Syrian refugees. There was certainly some kind of suffering. Hopefully we'll know more about exactly what caused it outside Damascus last week. The allegation is chemical weapons. And there have been 100,000-plus deaths in Syria. But we've got more than something like 2 million refugees who have poured out of the country, 1 million-plus children at this point. Some of those images have just been heartbreaking of families headed out just in the recent days. We've seen across desert and mountain. Kate Washington joins us right now from Amman in neighboring Jordan, neighboring to Syria. Kate oversees the Syrian refugee response work in Jordan for the humanitarian organization CARE. Kate Washington, thank you very much for joining us. What is the best estimate now of how many refugees have come out of Syria?
Hi, Tom. Thank you. You're right. We're looking at about 2 million at the moment. Just a little bit more than 2 million refugees have left Syria in the last year and a half.
And how are they, broadly speaking, distributed around its perimeter?
Here in Jordan, we have around 500,000, a little bit more. It's about 525,000. In Lebanon, you're seeing a figure of over 700,000. And over in Turkey, we're also seeing a number of about 440,000. The smaller numbers of Syrian refugees also seeking refuge in Iraq and in Egypt. And we even hear of refugees going as far away as Yemen or Morocco seeking refuge.
Kate, to the extent you can, speak about who's leaving Syria. Is it people who find themselves directly in the line of fire, or is it particular ethnic or religious groups who find them, who feel themselves acutely vulnerable?
It's really very, very mixed. We are seeing people who have been directly affected by fire or by violence in their areas. They have chosen to leave either just before attacks are going to take place, or indeed once their homes have been destroyed. In Jordan, the majority of the refugee population are Sunni, and they are from the province of Dara, which is the neighboring province to Syria.
How is Jordan, where you are now, how is it handling this enormous influx?
It's very, very challenging. The government of Jordan has been amazingly generous in allowing, as I said, over 500,000 refugees to come into Jordan. Jordan is a very small country. It has a population of a little bit more than 6 million. Mm. So you can imagine that 500,000 people is extremely challenging,
yeah,
and is putting pressure on all of the public services. Syrian refugees are able to access public schooling and public health facilities, but that is an enormous challenge, as I said. Many of the schools are now running double shifts, trying to accommodate those Syrian children into classes. And the same with medical facilities. We're often hearing hospitals really, really struggling to find beds or to be able to provide medicine to all the people who are in need.
What is the primary source of financial support for these refugee camps and needs in Jordan and beyond, Kate? Is it the UN? Is it something else? What?
No, I mean, the UN are constantly looking for further support. The UN supports the camps in Zaatari in the north, and they are responsible for those, and they take funding from international donors. That funding still remains rather low for what's needed. We're looking to the international donors to really be able to step that up in the next 6 months, as we're expecting to see increasing numbers of Syrian refugees flooding into the country, not just Jordan, of course, but also into Lebanon and Turkey.
I mean, CARE has seen refugee flows in many parts of the world, sadly. I'm sure you have. I have, you know, Cambodia into Thailand and you name it, all over the place. And it's always terrible, that kind of displacement. Among the refugee problems that we've seen in recent decades, how would you describe or weigh the circumstances of these Syrians in Jordan and beyond?
I think one of the things that people often miss when we think about this word refugee is we have one image of a refugee, which is a refugee living in a camp. Something that really distinguishes this refugee crisis from perhaps some of the others that you mentioned is that the vast majority of these Syrian refugees have moved into urban areas or non-camp areas and are really being lost amongst the urban poor. So they're living in very low-quality housing. They're very difficult to access. And they come and may not actually have a full understanding of what their rights are or who's able to help and support them.
But that may mean even bigger implications for the quote-unquote host countries. These are mingling right in among their population in Jordan and elsewhere.
Absolutely. You wouldn't be able to tell a Syrian from a Jordanian or from a Lebanese person. So they are not visible in the way that they are in camps, and that makes them, as I said, much, much more difficult to access. But it also means that a lot of the burden of care falls on the communities that they've settled in.
What about a return? Do people talk about return? Do they have any kind of circumstance that they can see on the horizon that would permit a return to Syria?
I think when people were first coming last year, they were extremely hopeful that they would be able to return in relatively quickly. People were thinking that this would be a 3-month, perhaps 6-month stay over in a neighboring country, and then they would be able to go back to their homes. Now, increasingly, people are not talking about that. They're all looking at how are they going to be able to manage in very expensive urban areas for the next 6, 8, 9, who knows, months. They've come with very limited resources, and those resources are now being eaten away. And families are extremely worried about how they're going to be able to maintain roofs over their heads or keep their kids in school.
As there remains no end in sight to the terrible conflict in Syria. Kate Washington is Syrian, oversees Syrian refugee response in Jordan for the humanitarian organization CARE. Kate, in Amman, Jordan, thank you very much for your insights today. Thank you for joining us for a few minutes.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for being with us in this hour. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to look at American universities responding to President Obama's cost-cutting push to rank them by value and maybe punish the losers. Join us for that. On Point is produced by Emily Alfin Johnson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.